Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, we are discussing tubal ligation, an irreversible medical procedure that stops women from getting pregnant. Why are young women in Kenya opting to do it? And a new regulation in Spain gives migrant workers a chance to get their papers in order. Njeri has been telling us about the kind of work she's had to do because she's undocumented.
So I've done babysitting, I've cleaned houses, I have worked in a club washing toilets. So yeah, it's really hard because like when you go to the club to clean toilets and you're thinking like, oh my God, I have a master's degree and I'm here cleaning toilets in a club at night. Like, that is not the kind of lifestyle I envisioned for myself. So I really cried that night.
Listen in to Follow Njeri's story. It's Tuesday, the 10th of December. First, we go to Libya. As you know, Libya has been caught in the throes of a civil war following the overthrow of Colonel Muammar Gaddafi back in 2011 during region-wide turmoil that became known as the Arab Spring. The country is currently divided into two broad regions, the West with a UN-backed government of national unity based in the capital Tripoli, and the East, which is controlled by General Khalifa Haftar. But in reality, different parts are controlled by different armed groups. Libya has vast quantities of oil, the largest reserves in Africa. Control of that oil and the cash that flows from it has resulted in further conflict and stuttering attempts at peace. Right now, UN brokered elections are indefinitely postponed. Enter the African Union, an organization that almost never gets credit for solving problems. It had tried to mediate an exit for President Gaddafi back in 2011. That mission, led by then South African President Jacob Zuma, did not get off the ground. Now, Congo's President Denis Sassou Nguesso, as chair of the AU's Libya Committee, is visiting the rival capitals of the East and the West to explore a path to reconciliation. We'll talk about that mission in a bit more detail shortly, but let's do a quick explainer on what exactly the African Union is and what role it plays in African politics.
The African Union, or the AU, is an organization made up of African countries. Its aim is to bring the 55 member states together to work on political and economic cooperation. The AU's headquarters are in Addis Ababa, the capital of Ethiopia. It was officially launched in July 2002 in Durban, South Africa, following a decision made in 1999 by its predecessor, the Organization of the African Unity, or OAU, to create a new organization. African leaders decided that in order for Africa to reach its full potential, they needed to shift focus from fighting for independence and ending apartheid to increasing cooperation and integration between African countries. The leader role of the organization is rotated on annual basis, and its current head is Mohamed Ould Ghazouni. The AU debate issues affect the whole continent and gives advice to the heads of states. Some of its main goals are to promote greater unity and solidarity among African countries and their people, to defend the sovereignty, territorial integrity, and the independence of its member states, to speed up political and socio-economic integration across the continent. An example of the AU's success is its work with the United Nations to help prevent violence and protect people in countries like Burundi, Central African Republic, and South Sudan. In 2022, the AU also helped negotiate a peace deal with Ethiopia and the Tigray People's Liberation Front. However, despite its goals and efforts, the AU is not without its challenges. The organization is still working to become more effective in addressing issues across the continent.
Now to the AU mission in Libya. Tim Eaton is a senior research fellow in the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House here in London.
It's not exactly clear to me what the goals of the AU meeting will be, where the AU has engaged in Libya of late has been particularly on talks around a reconciliation track of discussions, which looks to bridge the divides between Libyans of various persuasions and different communities in the aftermath of the overthrow of the Gaddafi regime. So that's been an area where the AU has been looking to support Libya. And also, up until last year, the special representative of the UN was an African national, and the AU was part of his attempts to solve the Libyan crisis. However, since his departure, Abdoulaye Bethily gave the reason for his resignation as effectively being the unwillingness of the key players in Libya to come to the table and negotiate. He criticized their self-interest. And Bethily was committed to supporting a track of reconciliation. But since his departure, that track of reconciliation hasn't really gone anywhere. So those elite interests have effectively become a major stumbling block to any UN efforts. And I think at the moment where we are in Libya is that there is two sets of opinions. One is that these elites that are in power should be allowed to further consolidate and stabilize the country. And the other is that there needs to be a more consensus-based solution to the conflict that meets the expectations of the public. I think that the African Union, in its engagement in the past, has been in support of the latter, but there is currently no UN process to support, and so the landscape remains quite uncertain.
Can you just lay out for us the African Union's relationship with Libya historically?
Looking historically, Gaddafi made a pivot to Africa in the 1990s, where he sought to bolster his relations with African states and really to place Libya in a much more pan-Africa kind of posture. And this involved investments across the continent, building political relationships with leaderships of African states. And so in that context, he had a lot of supporters on the African continent and many supporters within the African Union. So in the early aftermath of the uprisings, the AU seemed to be willing to engage and mediate, and the willingness of certain African states, such as South Africa, to mediate was viewed as somewhat of a pro-Gaddafi posture, and in that sense was not really welcomed by the rebels or those who sought the overthrow of the regime. I think over time that African Union posture has been less of a strong perspective of the AU as being pro-Gaddafi in that sense, or other African states remaining pro-Gaddafi. But there's been a bit of a reluctance to seek AU mediation.
The AU often emphasizes African solutions to African problems. Now, is this approach more successful in sub-Saharan Africa compared to countries in North Africa like Libya and Tunisia and Egypt, where Mediterranean and Middle Eastern interests also play a role?
I think that is the case. Clearly, when it comes to Libya, the cultural identity of vast majority of the population is that of being Arab and being Muslim. So influences come from the Middle East region, and Libyans very much see themselves as part of that community, and probably more part of that community than of African community. Of course, given Libya's geographic location as well on the Mediterranean coast, that makes it very proximate to Europe as well. So European powers have had a strong role in terms of negotiations over what's happened, engaging after 2011, both militarily and politically. So the political landscape really is dominated by the regional powers in the Middle East and the Europeans. Though, of course, Russia and the US is also involved, I think you would say that other African states have been somewhat less influential. And in fact, Libya is very poorly integrated into economies, even in North Africa, let alone sub-Saharan Africa. So that's perhaps the reason why the African solutions to African problems element is not seen to be quite as potent in Libya.
Why is President Sassou Nguesso and the AU undertaking this visit now? Has it got to do with the fact that Libya's instability has significant ripples, if ripple effects across the continent, particularly in the Sahel? Or is it specifically about Libya and the need to sort what's going on in Libya?
In truth, I'm not privy to the thinking for the specific timing of the visit. What I would suggest, back to my previous response, is that I think that this engagement on a reconciliation track among Libyans is a point of discussion for the African Union. And I would imagine as well that this trip serves as somewhat of a scoping opportunity to understand when and how the AU might engage more widely. Of course, there should be opportunities here because there are strong interconnections and interdependencies between Libya and the wider African continent. Issues around migration, of course, are front and center. But of course, the developments in the Sahel, the growth of military juntas, and the relationships that are developing between Libyan actors and those military juntas are also of interest, I am sure. So I think that there's plenty to discuss, both on a political level and also in terms of any role that the AU might seek to play in terms of seeking solutions to different elements of the Libyan conflict.
So is this the beginning and a turning point in the AU's involvement in Libya, or are there sort of timelines and goals and milestones that we can look forward to?
I think it's hard to say. The AU has consistently sought to engage in Libya. I think the high watermark of that engagement was under the former special representative, Abdoulaye Bathily. But since that point, it's not clear where they will dock in with other efforts. And in fact, we don't have a new permanent special representative from the UN. So I would say that the African Union needs to find its place and discover whether it can continue with its reconciliation efforts. And I think this will remain to be seen, but certainly a very difficult environment for them to be influential in when there are so many other external actors that are seeking to influence events on the ground.
Tim Eaton, Senior Research Fellow, Chatham House. Young women in Kenya have been doing something quite radical. They've been undergoing an operation called tubal ligation. It's a form of permanent contraception usually performed on older women for a variety of medical reasons. It is irreversible, and it isn't exactly a walk in the park. In the olden days, we used to hear our mothers and aunties talk in low voices about someone having their tubes cut. But the young women who've been sharing their thoughts and experiences on social media say they are motivated by a desire for alternative family structures, changing views on sexual orientation, and a growing sense of personal freedom. Thing is, they are very young women, between the ages of 18 and 30, and most of them haven't had children. It got us thinking, because health experts recommend waiting till you are older, 35 plus, before considering tubal ligation for any reason. Nelly Naisula Sironka has had the procedure. She's 28 years old, so why did she do it?
It's something I have been meaning to do. This just felt like the right time. And I've always known that I do not want children. It's not that I ever wanted kids and then I changed my mind, because most people assume that was the case, because they'll ask, at what point did you know this was a decision for you? Through and through, kids have never crossed my mind. And when they did, it's from the perspective of, I'm sure I don't want kids. I don't know that I've answered your question.
Well, I mean, it's just awoken more questions in me, because I'm also one of those women who thought from a very young age that I'm not sure about this child thing. And then I actually decided that I didn't want to have children. But
I didn't know that.
Well, I didn't know I was going to tell you that. But tubal ligation is not something that crossed my mind. I mean, I didn't think that that's what I should do. It didn't even seem like an option to me.
Oh, really? Mm. Okay, so maybe mine had some layers of complexity. I experience a lot of hormonal imbalance. So I do have a thyroid problem. And I also have PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome.
Right. Which is something that makes women experience very heavy periods, abnormal hair growth, weight gain, fatigue,
correct,
and so on. Okay.
Yes, you got that right.
Right.
So a combination of those hormonal issues for me, I tried other forms of contraception, and they did not work for me. But I have to say, the decision to get a tubal ligation was not only because of my medical issues. It was also, for me, a way of solidifying this decision that I have made, especially because I am getting to an age where the society I come from have a certain expectation of me getting children and so on and so forth. So I wanted to make this decision for myself and solidify. So more than anything, what I was trying to avoid is external influences trying to come in and change my mind, because I was sure I didn't want kids, but then I did not want to cave into the pressure of my family or, you know, just external pressure. And so that's what informed this decision for the most part.
Did you discuss it with close family members? You had a partner at the time. Did you discuss it with them? And what was their reaction? Or did you just decide to go it alone? You told no one? You just went for it?
I did not discuss this with my family. Some of them still don't know that I did this. Let me say, two of them know that my brother and sister know that I took the procedure, but they only learned a few days after my surgery. I did disclose this to a friend, but it was more of informing her. But I did not have, you know, a conversation or anything of that sort with anyone in my life.
How did your brother and your sister react?
They were expecting it, so
Oh, they were shocking. Okay.
Yes, yes. It's because I've mentioned severally in conversations with my family, you know, I don't want children. I'm not even sure about marriage, and especially traditional kind of marriage setup. So it's not something that took them by surprise. It was just a matter of when is she going to do it, not if she's going to do it.
So you were very clear about this, and you're very happy to tell the world right now that you've done it. So if close family find out, do you think that they're going to be disappointed, concerned, upset, and do you care?
I really don't care, because this was a decision for me. And if I had that baby that maybe someone really wanted me to have, I would still be the one to, you know, take on the responsibility of taking care of that child. So this is a very selfish decision for myself. And so I really don't care what anyone feels about it. With regards to my close family, I have mentioned previously that I am not interested in children. That's not something that I want to take up in this life. So I'm not very concerned about their reactions. And I think also because of how vocal I am about what I stand for, and also how unconventional my life is, then they know what to expect from me. And so this would not be very shocking, I would say.
You said that you're being selfish about this. It's a decision you took entirely for yourself. Why do you feel that it's a selfish thing for you to have done? Because that sort of implies that you're judging yourself.
When I use the word selfish, I use it with a lot of pride. And so it has nothing to do with judging myself. More than anything, I'm so proud of myself for making a very, you know, selfish decision for me. And I choose to use that word because women have, for the longest, been givers. You know, you are a primary caregiver, especially as a mother, even as an older sister, as a firstborn daughter, as a firstborn sibling, you are expected to give so much. And so for me to use the word selfish is I'm choosing myself. I am choosing my interests. I am choosing my freedom of time, finances. So more than anything, the word selfish here is being used to reclaim my agency. It's used to reclaim my freedom. And it's used here to reclaim my choice.
I hear you about the, you know, firstborn daughter and all of those things and the pressures that women either take on themselves or get put on themselves. Mm-hmm. I am wondering, though, do you worry that, I mean, and it's barely 6 weeks since you've done this, but when you thought about changes in your views in the future, because you are only 28, I will say, and so there's lots of scope for change of mind? Or do you feel that you had thought about it very clearly, and this is definitely the path upon which you will build your life. I know that not everybody can say that, and lots of things change over time for everybody.
Oh, for sure.
But for you, this particular procedure is irreversible.
Yes, I have considered that. And even as I was getting, you know, just before the procedure, where you see to the doctor and you actually discuss the implications, what this procedure means for you, we did discuss at length that this is final, right? It's irreversible. And I actually have sat down with myself and considered that people change their minds, right? People get fresh perspectives, and I'm just 28, I might get to 40, and I'm like, oh my goodness, I actually do want a child. But the beauty for me is that down the line, if anything like that were to happen, I'm very open to adopting. I know that I still have IVF as an option, but that is a last thing on my mind. You know, I have never sat on the fence when it comes to kids. I've always been, I do not want kids. But in the instance that I change my mind, I know that I still have options out there, such as adoption and IVF.
You make me laugh when you say you were never on the fence. Neither was I. But I also did sit with myself. And at some point, I actually asked my mother, you know, do you mind that, you know, this is a decision I've taken? My mother said, oh, I've got lots of grandchildren. It's fine. Enjoy your life.
I like that. And it's so interesting you bring that up. Yesterday, I was with my sister. And because I am yet to actually disclose this to my mother, I would hate for her to find out through this podcast.
So you better tell her today.
So I was talking to my sister yesterday, and she was telling me, I think you should tell mom that, you know, you got your tube stent. You should tell her today when we are here together. And I asked her, what do you think her reaction would be? And she was like, you know, mom has ever mentioned to me that I should tell you to get your tubes tied. And I found that so interesting. Yes. I found that so interesting. And I asked her, are you for real? Are you telling me this because you've already went and told her my message or my story to tell? And she was like, no, no, no. We had the conversation and she was like, you know, you deal with a lot of hormonal issues. And because you already know you don't want kids, why don't you just tie your tubes?
Okay, it sounds like your job will be easy then in that case.
Yeah.
But what did the medical professional that you were dealing with say or do? Because I know that there's a lot of resistance in the medical profession to do as women ask. You know, they can be quite judgmental and say, well, you know, you're very young and I really shouldn't be doing this because I may be doing harm. And what happens if you change your mind? So were they quite open and responsive to your decision, your choice?
I would say yes, they were. You know, they actually explained to me that at your age and as someone who has no kids, typically, you know, you wouldn't get access to these services at just any other facility, but really took their time to help me understand that if I change my mind, this was irreversible. But I would say generally, they were really, really, really open to helping me make the right decision.
So they weren't trying to change your mind?
I wouldn't say they were. At some point, you know, the questioning became a bit, I was not becoming, let me not say angry, but worked up because there was a hypothetical man that was being brought up constantly. You know, what if you meet this man and he's the love of your life and he wants kids and you regret? And I'm like, why are we talking about a hypothetical man who does not exist, yet I'm here and I'm telling you this is what I want? So they were bringing up scenarios that did involve, you know, a non-existent man. And I think that was supposed to make me consider all my options as opposed to change my mind, maybe. But I wouldn't say they were in any way opposing or resisting offering the service that I was requesting for.
Do you think that it's freely available? Would somebody, you know, with not much money or not much of an income, young like you, considering this thing, would they be able to afford it?
I would say it's not accessible financially, but I also do know that there are health services out there in Kenya open to offering such services or similar services ready to meet you at your, you know, what you can afford. So the medical centers, certain clinics that will actually work with what it is you have. But I would say it is still not accessible. It's pretty pricey.
Yeah, and you do know that it's often been used as a weapon against women, right? In other settings and in at different times in history.
I know about that, and I see how problematic that can be, especially for women in, I would say, low-income communities that has been used against them.
And have you had time to reflect as you sit and sat with yourself after the procedure? What did you feel like before and after?
I have taken time to reflect. I love journaling, and I've done quite a bit of journaling about, you know, the whole procedure. Has anything changed? I feel like I've said yes to more opportunities and adventures than I typically do, because for me then, you know, as I said before, this procedure was like a symbol of my freedom, of my agency, of my choice. And so sometimes I want to turn down and say no to an opportunity. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, but Nelly, but Naisula, you did this procedure because you want to open up your life to more adventures and more opportunities. So say yes. So I think I've become more open-minded to exploring and adventures and opportunities. But I would say 6 weeks is still, I'm still very new to this other side of life. So maybe in a few months, I would have more to say about any changes that may have come up.
I was going to ask you to say a few words to people listening now and thinking that this might be an option for them. What would you say?
I would say, if you're on the fence about getting it, give yourself more time. But if you're not sure, then it's a no. I think having kids is one of those things where it's either a yes or a no. You really have, because you have to be very intentional about parenting. So if you're sure you do not want kids, yes, by all means, get the procedure, but also go into it knowing that it's final. But that doesn't mean that down the line, if you change your mind, then you don't have options to explore. Know that you can adopt or you can get an IVF. And yeah, all the best.
Thank you so much. It's been really interesting talking to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's 28-year-old Nelly Naisula Sironga, who has decided to have tubal ligation. We've been talking to Dr. Sandra Ngete about this, so let's listen to what she has to say.
My advice would be to take time to think it over, get advice from other parties, not because you don't have body autonomy, which I truly believe in. It is your body, it is your choice, and your future fertility depends on you. However, the regret rate is also quite high, because despite a failure rate of just 0.01%, it is a very effective contraception. And if it's something that you think you might regret later, reversal is usually not very successful, because the techniques that are used for the sterilization are quite destructive to the tubes. So if you think at any point that this is something that you might need to reverse in the future, then this might not be for you, and you should consider long-term contraception, non-hormonal, which is usually the reason for the sterilization, that people don't want to have hormones in their body. And I understand that the coil, which is the only non-hormonal long-term contraceptive, is not always favorable to everybody, but sterilization usually takes up to a year for you to be able to make that decision clearly. And it's not many people who would agree to do it. Why? Because the litigation is also quite high on patients who say that they did not fully understand. So that year is to take time to fully understand the benefits, the risks, the indications, and the implications of your decision.
This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. Now to Spain, and what appeared on the face of it to be good news for undocumented people trying to get into the country. Like so many other European nations, Spain has been enforcing strict border controls to try and control the inflows of people from elsewhere. Like other European populations, the Spanish have been complaining that people in the country illegally are a burden on their public services. So when Spain said it will legalize about 300,000 undocumented people a year for the next 5 years, We sat up and took notice because the Canary Islands in Spain is the closest point to Africa, and many young men from places like Mali, Senegal and Mauritania see it as a step towards continental Europe. So what is the policy? How will it benefit people who are fleeing war and famine or persecution in their home countries? We spoke to Lorenzo Gabrielli, a senior researcher for the Interdisciplinary Research Group on Immigration at the University Pompeu Fabra in Barcelona. Is Spain changing its approach to undocumented migrants?
No, not exactly the case. Spain has not changed its policy concerning people arriving in Canary Islands, for example, or in Ceuta and Melilla. The policy is still following the same previous pattern. There is no modification in this sense, so there is strong border control in Ceuta and Melilla, in cooperation with a transit country in North Africa, the case of Morocco, but also the case of Mauritania. Senegal, Gambia is still in place and is working maybe more than in previous period. So it's a kind of ambiguous policy in which you have this external dimension that's from the border and beyond the border is very strict. But for people already present in the country, there is this possibility to regularize their condition and to enter in the labor market.
Lorenzo Gabrielli, senior researcher for the Interdisciplinary Research Group on Immigration at the University Pompeu Fabra in Barcelona. Now let's meet Njeri, a Kenyan woman who is undocumented and living in Spain. We've been talking about her situation and what the hardest part of life is for someone in her shoes.
The hardest part of not having documents is the fact that you can't get a job. Like for me, I have a master's degree, I'm well educated, and I still can't find a job because once you apply for jobs, they tell you that you need to have documents. And if you don't have a job, it is hard to stay in a country because like you can't afford your rent, you need to buy food, you need to buy the transport ticket and everything. So I can say for the first maybe 1 year and a half, my parents used to send me money from home. And it is, so when you put the exchange rate, it's a lot of money.
So how did you manage? What kind of work did you have to do to survive?
Every kind of job. Like if someone just calls and they're like, hey, I'm looking for someone to do this. I was like, yes, yes, yes. So I have done babysitting. It was my first time doing babysitting, actually, so when I came here. So I've done babysitting. I've cleaned houses. I have worked in a club washing toilets. So, yeah. And it's really hard because like when you go to the club to clean toilets and you're thinking like, oh, my God, I have a master's degree and I'm here cleaning toilets in a club at night. Like that is not the kind of lifestyle I envisioned for myself. So I really cried that night. It was such a tough night. But
did you only ever do it once?
Yeah, I did it for 1 week. I did it because the job was temporary. So, yeah, I did it for 1 week and then I continued looking for babysitting jobs. So, and the downside about having babysitting jobs is that you can work with a family for a long time and then all of a sudden they just tell you like, hey, we don't need you anymore because maybe my husband decided to take a hiatus and he's going to be at home. So you have to find another way to stabilize yourself. And with such kind of jobs, it's not like you're going to have a lot of money to save. So with the little money you get, you just pay your rent, you buy food and everything. And at the end of the month, you literally have no money to save. So you need to constantly have a job.
So how did you keep your self-respect, your dignity, your sense of purpose together while all of this was going on?
Man, it's just to remind yourself like, hey, this is for a short time. It is not, you're not going to do these jobs for the rest of your life, you know? Like, you know, I kept on looking for ways to find papers. I have seen so many lawyers. And the thing with being illegal is that you have very minimal options. It's not like when you're a student. So you have to keep reminding yourself like, hey, you're not here to do this for the rest of your life, you know?
So how long will it take for you to know that your application has been successful?
6 months, which is going to be next year in the summer, and then about another 45 days for the card to be out. Because now I was thinking like, since I literally tried every option, everyone I have met in Spain, I called them asking them like, hey, I'm here illegally. I need to find a job because I didn't want to continue staying here illegally. Because then again, I'm remembering like my parents are back at home. Life is continuing back at home without me. They're getting older. And I did, like, God forbid, I didn't want something horrific to happen to my parents and then I'm not able to go back home, you know? So that is why I was just looking for that and also to find my stability, because I have been very unstable for the past 3 years. And it really takes a toll on you. Like, I remember one time I had come from babysitting at night and I was in the bus and I just started crying. And in the bus, they usually give you, it's like they're taking a survey to see how many people are taking the night bus. I think maybe so that they can increase the buses or they can reduce the buses. And so he approached me and was like, hey, are you ready to take this survey? Yeah, the survey, like the questionnaire and everything. And he just saw me bawling out. I was just like, oh, I'm so sorry. Like, whatever it is that you're going through, I really hope that you get through it. And I was just like, oh my God, this is just a total stranger. So what happened, but...
He was showing you compassion. Tell me, how do people generally treat somebody like you in Spain?
If they know that you don't have documentation, it's going to be, they're going to treat you differently. Because recently I was living with a lady in her house and I didn't have a house contract. And she was asking me to pay rent for the following month and I wanted to move out because she was treating me really horribly. Like, if I wanted to hang my clothes, she was like, I'm not going to unhang mine. So I had to go to the laundry to dry them. If I want to cook, that is when she wants to come and cook. Like, I could not have my friends over, even just one friend, even just to study and stuff like that. So I told her that I'm going to move out and she told me that, hey, you can't move out. You have to pay me rent for the following month. And I'm like, I can't pay you rent for the following month because I'm moving. So she called the police and the police came to the house. And the reason as to why she called the police, it is because she knew that I didn't have documentation. Anyway, so the police come and they ask me like, hey, can you give me your documents? And of course I could not give them my residency card because it had already expired. So I had to give them my passport because at least the passport doesn't show like when your residency permit expired. Anyway, so that guy asked me like, well, what are you doing in Spain? And I'm like, I'm a student and I don't have any contract in this house. And that is why I want to move because I'm being treated badly. And so, yeah, things like those happen.
But did the police do? Were they kind to you?
Yeah, the police were kind because the woman had even closed the door and she had told me that you can't leave until you pay me the rent. And I can't pay rent for the following month that I'm not going to be there.
So the police just dismissed the case. They said no.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So the police just told her like, hey, she cannot pay the rent for the following month because she's moving. And I told the police like, hey, can you please stay here until I'm done packing? And they asked me like, how long am I going to take to pack? And I told them 45 minutes anyway, but they said they had somewhere else to go. But anyway, eventually ended up leaving. But anyway, so things like this can happen. But generally in Spain, it's not as bad as maybe countries like the US where people stop you in the street and they ask you for documentation.
Her name is Njeri, and she's in the process of getting her papers sorted in Spain. Focus on Africa was delicately woven together by Susan Gachui in Nairobi, Bella Hassan and Sunita Nahar worked from here in London. Carney Sharp was the senior journalist, Johnny Hall our technical producer, Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. We are on air, in a pod and on YouTube. I'm Audrey Brown and we'll talk again next time.